This episode of Earl Grey is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org.
I'm Daniel Davis. I played Professor James Moriarty on Star Trek The Next Generation, and you're listening to Trek FM.
T.L. Greyhawk.
Welcome to another cup of Earl Grey, Trek FM's dedicated podcast to the next generation. I'm your host, Justin Ozer. Amy is away this week, but join with me today is Joe Keegan. Joe, how are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm good, Justin. Amy's away again. She's still not back from that undercover mission that she was on last week.
Well, I think we can reveal here she's at a panel at the FanX convention in Salt Lake City. Well, we're not doing undercover missions this
That's
week,
true.
Like lower cover.
She's done the panel now. At FanX, yeah. So we can reveal to our audience. And apparently it went quite well.
Yeah, and well, she was there with Haley Stoddard of Standard Orbit, Brandy Jacola of Live from the Edge, and I think Zachary Fruling, who does Metatrex and To the Journey, was on that panel as well about diversity in Star Trek. So I think they recorded some audio, so hopefully we'll hear that coming up. But that's why Amy's away. We do have a special guest, but first, let's go through some of your Babel Conference feedback. This is for Earl Grey 288, where we talked about our favorite villains. We got some great feedback on that one. So, Joe, you want to read the first comment?
I don't know if it's so great feedback, but we'll go nonetheless.
I saved the best for you for last. Let's just say that.
Thank you, Justin. So, Greg Malumbi says, interesting selections. I don't agree with some of them, in brackets Jellicoe, but it was a nice discussion. My three favorite villains. Tom Locke, how he wasn't even mentioned, I have no idea. Q, in the first few seasons, he was a villain. And Lore. You could have also said that the crystalline entity in terms of the nature versus nurture thing too, when talking about Armis and Nagelum. Yeah, Greg, I agree with your favourite villain selections. The thing about Star Trek is that there's no end of villains to choose from, so we could have done many podcasts and talked about it for many hours. No idea why nobody else thinks that Jellicoe is not a villain. That's just all I'm going to say.
You did get a lot of people saying, Jellicoe, a villain? We'll see more about that. But like, Greg, I think those are some interesting selections. I totally agree about Lore. I think he is a really great villain. Q, I don't know. I'm not so sure about, because I think he does do some things that seem really harmful in the first few seasons, but... So maybe there is an argument more there, but he does end up helping things out or helping Picard and the Enterprise later on. So I guess I don't as much see him as a villain. Now, Tomalak's an interesting one because he is definitely, you know, has the Romulan ship and he is threatening the Enterprise and all of that. But I think that he's kind of doing what he's been taught to do. I don't think of him as a villain in the sense of like he's just like gone way off base and is just evil. I think for the most part, he's just doing what Romulan commanders do. But anyway, it's interesting choices, Greg.
Anytime I see Tomalak, I can't help but see Jakar from Babylon 5, played by Andreas Katsoulis, mm-hmm. who's an amazing actor. I can't see Tomalak. I don't see a Romulan. I see Jakar.
I see that now because I hadn't actually seen really much of Babylon 5 until recently, but I can definitely see that. Yep. All right, so Kimberly Lawler says, well, this discussion went in some interesting directions. I'm a Jellicoe fan, so I didn't agree with him being a villain in any conventional sense. Sorry, Joe.
It's okay.
But definitely agreed with the Madred pick. The thing about Madred was you got all the background and complexity, but ultimately you see he is really just a sadist who's torturing Picard just as a power play to break him personally. I think there is no way to justify the schism's aliens' actions. This was a very X-Files-like episode with the alien abductions, and nope, cannot be justified. Cutting off a sentient being's arm and all the other stuff they did was pretty terrible. Amy Nelson, you forgot one other villain who killed a main TNG cast member, at least temporarily, Alcar killing Troy. Such a hammy episode, but worth it for Beverly's solution to the problem and the sweet moment that Will and Deanna have at the end. So thanks, Kimberly. So yeah, a couple of things about your comments. Madred, I think that is one of the things that makes him a villain. He's just kind of doing it to try to really torture Picard and maybe hasn't even been ordered to go that far. It becomes very personal. For the Schism's aliens, I agree that their actions are very bad in what they do. But it is kind of interesting, I mention it, but there is a novel called Sight Unseen, which goes more into their society and they have different factions and things. So it makes it more interesting that way. And for Alcar killing Troy, that must be in, my God, Joe, why am I forgetting the episode? One where the guy has his psychic garbage that he's trying to give away to other people.
I saw that comment and I was kind of stuck on. I was like, who on earth is Alcar? And I didn't actually get around to Googling it. Ves Alcar was a Lumerian representative.
Man of the people, that's the one.
Or was he on board with his family? Oh no, that was a different episode with telepathic.
I think you're thinking of a different one. But basically, he's like this diplomat, and he has all this like psychic waste or garbage that he gives to other people, and he has some assistant that like ages a lot. Sound familiar now?
Oh yeah, and Troy gets really, really, really old.
Yeah.
Yes.
That one. So, but yes, Kimberly, she did get temporarily killed in that one.
Yeah, Kimberly, the Madred thing. The discussions that we had on Madred really highlights how villainous he actually is. And I love the fact that you get all that background, how you meet his daughter, but then it just turns out he just wants to torture Picard and try and get whatever secrets he can get out of them. Still not convinced of the Schism's aliens, though, because they're in another layer of subspace. Did we see them as like humanoid? Or was that just our brain's way of interpreting what subspace aliens looked like?
It's a good question.
Interesting. So, Tim Robertson says, great conversation, but Captain Jellicoe a villain? Time travel? I don't get that one at all. But the thing that really made me scratch my head was Amy Nelson's comment that the only thing wrong with Nemesis was that Shinson should have had hair. That's the only thing wrong with that movie. Thanks for your comment, Tim. Yes, Captain Jellicoe is definitively a villain based on my definition at the beginning of the episode. If you want to go back and re-listen, my selection matches my definition.
And I think many people would disagree with your definition, which was basically just that, what, that the things get changed up a lot?
It makes the viewer, somebody that makes the viewer feel uncomfortable with what's going on.
Okay.
So it's a loose definition, villain.
Okay.
Granted.
Yeah, by your definition. So Tim, very nice way of taking shots at all three of us. Joe's selection of Captain Jellicoe as a villain, mine
like
for
the
time
way
travel.
That it wasn't just me.
Yeah, and Amy Nelson for Shinzon. So equal opportunity insults to all of us. No, we love you, Tim. We really do. We get the spirit that you have it in, but it's great that you listened. You had a reaction to it.
Yeah. Love Tim. Don't love his gnomes.
I know. You don't love his gnomes. I think gnomes are awesome.
No.
All right. So we have Stefan Ringline who says, great episode, guys. Very good picks and interesting discussion on what makes a good, relatable, and believable villain. Justin, I liked your way of thinking outside the box with time travel, but I also like Joe's response with space travel. Laughed out loud walking on the street. When Amy was about to unveil her villain, Armis, I also thought she was going to say Shinzon. I agree with Joe to a certain extent that Jellicoe might be perceived as a villain watching the episode for the first time. The writers did a good job to irritate the audience with him and his character. Two of my favorite villains in TNG, there are so many good ones, are Kivas Fajo and Ardra. Outside of TNG, it would be Dukat, because he starts slow but gets more layers each season. So thank you, Stefan.
Thank you, Stefan. Thank you.
Yeah, and for supporting Joe, at least somewhat, in his selection of Jellicoe as a villain.
At least I've got one ally.
I think he was maybe the only one. And Kivas Fajo in The Most Toys is a great one. I think that's come up a couple times. We probably need to talk about that episode more, right?
I think that was in one of our honorable mentions, wasn't it, Kivas Fajo?
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Yeah, thanks, Stefan. Really appreciate the comments. And thanks, everyone, for your Babel Conference feedback.
Thank you.
All right. So join with us today is a special guest who has been on Earl Grey before. It's Shoaib Mirza. Shoaib, welcome back to Earl Grey.
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah. Great to have you here.
I'm looking forward to the talk today.
Yeah. You know, last time that we had you on, it was for favorite conflict resolution moments. And I think that was me, you, and Amy, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And this time, so you had some other topics that you had sent us, and I wanted to just talk about the topic that you sent us that that Joe and I had agreed we should take a look at. So it says, the power of words, language, and communication on TNG. Star Trek has never shied from grandiose dialogue, is full of complicated terms, technobabble, and Shakespeare. What moments or episodes pushed your own vocabulary and taught you something? So we're going to go off of that topic, however the three of us interpret it, for top three choices and an honorable mention. So I'm just curious why you wanted to talk about this topic or how you came up with it.
I'd say, like I've expressed before, Star Trek has been in my life for as long as I can remember, and a lot of my own personality, my own vocabulary, my way of dealing with people has been influenced by what I've watched on screen for this many years. So to me, especially watching TNG, their style of speaking is so refined, especially amongst the crew. And that's something which I've always found was really empowering. Because when you're communicating with others, you want to express yourself, but do it in a really polite way where you can get those your emotions, the ideas across, but also expand your vocabulary was really important to me growing up, because I have like 2-3 languages at home, not just English being spoken. So it's kind of a extra way of learning for me as well. So that's sort of where I came up with the idea.
Okay, that's excellent. And it'll be interesting to see how we interpreted the topic, because I know I may have interpreted it maybe a little differently than others did. We'll see.
Is this another time travel thing?
No, I was going to say, no time travel for me, as long as Jellicoe doesn't come into this.
Sure, okay, we'll make that deal then. Awesome. I'm in.
All right. So Shoaib, since you picked the topic and you're guesting with us here, what's your first pick?
Okay, I'm going to go in like reverse to the one that was my third pick and then go down.
Okay.
That's okay. So the first one is from Schisms, season 6, episode 5. And it's a really famous scene. Now, as you can watch on YouTube, people watch it like crazy. It's the Ode to Spot scene.
Oh.
Where he's reciting his poem he wrote, his original work about his cat. And I don't know, I thought I would at least read it so everyone could get refreshed.
Yes.
Sure, yeah.
The contents, okay.
We would have insisted that you do a recital.
Yeah, I was about
recital.
To ask you to read
okay.
it.
Okay,
yeah.
Ready?
And your best data, please.
Okay. Felis catus is your taxonomic nomenclature, an endothermic quadruped carnivorous by nature. Your visual, olfactory, and auditory senses contribute to your hunting skills and natural defenses. I find myself intrigued by your subvocal oscillations, a singular development of cat communications that obviates your basic hedonistic predilection for a rhythmic stroking of your fur to demonstrate affection. A tail is quite essential for your acrobatic talents. You would not be so agile if you lacked its counterbalance. And when not being utilized to aid in locomotion, it often serves to illustrate the state of your emotion. O-Spot, the complex levels of behavior you display connote a fairly well-developed cognitive array. And though you are not sentient, Spot, and do not comprehend, I nonetheless consider you a true and valued friend. Oh, man, that's Aww. A lot All of right. words in there. I love that poem, though.
You know, I was thinking of interrupting you partway through where, like, Riker's asleep and he thinks
yeah,
it's over.
Yeah.
But no.
That scene is classic.
That was a great job. And there are so many like complex words and things that you just don't say every day in that poem. Yeah. So you did a great job reciting that. And it is very memorable in that episode for sure. What do you think, Joe?
It's interesting because whenever I watch that episode, I'm not sure, because I'm not an English teacher. Yeah. So I don't know how that would be graded as a poem. or an ode in this case, if it's really artistic and clever or it's just kind of funny. The reason I like it is because it's just full of science. Like me just now kind of understands all the words. Me as a teenager kind of understood them by its context, but then had to go away and look up all the words. Kind of, so there's lots, like quadruped, you obviously four-legged, carnivorous, we know what that means. Olfactory, I'd never heard of the word olfactory before, but it's to do with your sense of smell. And there's just so much of it. It's just a, it's brilliant, isn't it?
The way I saw this when I was thinking of moments, there's so many moments, obviously, in Trek, especially TNG. But I was thinking of Data. The first thing I thought was Data. Throughout the series, he's like, Snoop, sir? And Picard's like, what do you mean, Snoop? Data, how can you not know the word Snoop? You have all the encyclopedia of human knowledge. You don't know the word Snoop. And then he's going, processing, and he's like, oh, Snoop, to stealthily go and do this and whatever. So I was just thinking, this is quintessential Data at his best. He's going to tell you all the information, and he's going to, you know, show his emotions, which he doesn't have.
Yeah, I think like a couple of things. I think of the talent of the writers who wrote that stuff, and they wrote it in a way. And I was looking it up on Memory Alpha. It's in iambic heptameter. I think iambic pentameter is more common, but like they wrote it in like a certain specific way and tried to stick to that, and tried to stick to how Data would do poetry. And it just illustrates something great about his character, also, which is he is this android. He's supposed to not really have emotions, but you see him trying to do poetry and painting and playing the violin. He's trying to do all of these creative pursuits, which are not required for his duties or his survival or anything like that. But he is really curious to branch out. And it's just really great that he makes it such a like formal scientific thing. It's kind of funny. But at the same time, it's kind of sweet because that's his way of expressing his affection without doing it emotionally. So,
right.
Yeah.
Even the fact that I'm on Memory Alpha just now, it says iambic heptameter, and that is totally what Data would do. He would probably go with some really obscure kind of mode of writing and do that.
Yeah.
And iambic heptameter is to do with the fact that each line, I think, has 14 syllables, which is interesting in itself.
Yeah, well, that the hepta part is like for seven, so there's seven like feet or like I guess groups of syllables or something. Yeah, yeah. It's very interesting that he does that, and he does it in such a specific way. Yeah, but I think we'll see what other things we come up with. But I think you've chosen the one that probably expands our vocabulary the most, Shoaib, in the first pick, because there's lots of words in there that even when I'm listening to it, I'm like, okay, that means that. Maybe look at that. You know,
instead of going through your own personal vocabulary, right? Trying to figure out what he means.
I think when I first heard it, I was like, oh, Data's being really formal. I didn't really think about it and like analyze it until later what he's actually saying.
Yeah, so.
Yeah. I suppose you could rewrite a much simpler version, replacing all the scientific words with kind of normal everyday words like your sight, smell, and hearing senses. Yeah.
Yeah, the way he writes it is like he's like a fourth year doctorate student, right? Trying to just do poetry, like most analytical and straightforward way without any dumbed down words, I'd say.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, great pick for sure. So, Joe, your first pick.
Right, kind of. It's not the same, but it's kind of chosen for the same reasons. And I had chosen the language used throughout that I was unfamiliar with as a teenager. And it was only recently that I discovered what they were actually saying a lot of the time when they say belay that order.
Oh, belay.
Yes. Uh-huh. So there's this auditory illusion that your brain fills in details if it doesn't quite understand what it hears. And I always heard delay that order,
which isn't
so different. It means like don't do something just now. But belay, it turns out, I've only discovered recently, means to disregard it altogether and completely, which is amazing. And there's some other examples, like in Best of Both Worlds, where they're on Jury 4 and Commander Shelby has beamed down early. There's the whole early bird gets the worm thing. And Data says there's no evidence of avifaunal or crawling vermicular life forms on Jury 4. And then there's another word Data says. He says, I believe Commander Shelby erred. And as a teenager, I'd never heard the word erred before, meaning to have made a mistake. So it's all things like that. There's something that LaForge says about Shelby. It's a bit of a, it's the way he says it, and it's the way his lips move and make it sound like it felt like a bit of a tongue twister. She's a formidable presence, to say the least. And it is quite difficult to say. She's a formidable presence, to say the least, which I found interesting. So there's just lots of words there that it taught me a lot.
Yeah, and that's a great pick, because it is something that I've thought of, because I think it's quite possible before I started really watching Star Trek and concentrating on it, I'd never really heard the word belay. I guess it goes to maybe like a naval kind of tradition.
Yes, that's right.
I could be wrong here. But it is, does mean something very specific, and you do hear it in different parts of Star Trek. I was just looking up. You hear Kirk say it. You hear Picard say it. You hear Janeway say it. You hear Riker say it. I mean, there's different like parts in Star Trek where you hear people saying like belay that order, and it's usually something where somebody gives an order and they're like, no, we're not going to go ahead with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for something like aired, as a kid, you could be like A-I-R-E-D, yes. Which is different than E-R-R-E-D, like aired. So it is interesting, like also when you think about language, when you see something written on a page, it's very clear, like this is the word. But when you hear it spoken and you're not familiar with the word, you could interpret it a lot of different ways. And this happens with me also in music. I mishear lyrics like all the time, and I fill in things that I think it is.
Right.
It's the same kind of phenomenon.
Something that I learned when I was younger. Like I said, growing up in a house with several languages. So at school, I would be kind of lost in translation often in my first few years of grade school. So often that sort of trick I learned from one of my teachers was to try to infer what they mean. So you take the first few words that they're saying, then the last ones, and then you kind of extrapolate and interpolate what they meant by that. And that's really served me a lot in my life.
It's a bit like if you're in a really busy venue, like a nightclub or something, and somebody's talking to you. Usually young people, because they can hear perfectly in nightclubs, and they're talking at you, but you have no clue what they're saying. And so basically you have to kind of listen to their tone and their facial expressions so you know when to say yes and no.
Right. Well, and I've had the experience, I guess went to some concerts recently, and like it was loud enough that you can't hear anything unless someone is like directly like right near your ear, mm-hmm. like yelling into your ear. So, and I always find that weird to experience. But yeah, like it is easy to misinterpret things. So as a kid, you always thought it was delay, and then it was more recently you found out it was actually belay, which means something a little different. Yeah.
In relation to misheard lyrics, I'm a huge fan of Tori Amos, the American singer-songwriter. And she's famous for kind of not being lazy with the way she says anything, but leaving the ambiguous, then leaving the lyrics kind of really ambiguous, so there could be multiple meanings to what she's saying. So I think every Tori Amos lyric in existence I have misheard. it might as well just be a different song.
We might as well take a bit of a tangent on this, because like I think sometimes the way you hear something differently can really affect the interpretation of the song. So I'm going to give you guys just an example. So the example that I have, guys, because I didn't really even know the name of the song. So there's a song from the 60s, a Smokey Robinson and the Miracles song called I Second That Emotion, right? Which has like a very specific meaning, but I always heard it until, I don't know, 5 years ago as a secondhand emotion. For me that would interpret it differently. Like I know it's a weird thing to think about, like, but like an emotion that comes secondhand from someone else.
Okay.
So I was thinking all these years and then I was like, oh, it means something totally different. So, and like in your case, Joe, like delaying something until later is different than belaying, which is like disregard that. Right. So it just completely kind of changes the sense of the word.
Yeah. So. But in the moment they kind of mean the same thing. Like, they both mean don't do it right now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The best misheard lyric though, I still mishear it even though I know what they're singing, is the song Freed from Desire by I think Gala, where the line is my love has got no money, he's got his strong beliefs. Do you know the song?
No, maybe. I don't actually.
You Google it, yeah. So he's got his strong beliefs. I misheard. He's got strong beliefs. I misheard as Trump beliefs. And I thought Trump beliefs was a French word. I made this up in my head, like my head canon, yeah. Trump beliefs was like a French word meaning really baggy pants. Like MC Hammer pants. So like he's got money, but he's fine because he's got these really baggy trousers. He's got his strong beliefs.
I love that. That's awesome. All right. So since we've gone there, listeners, you might as well let us know your favorite misheard lyrics. That has nothing to do with Star Trek, but it does have to do with this discussion.
I think we should do a whole episode on misheard song lyrics. Yeah. It's not really Star Trek, but it would be hilarious.
Yeah. Patreon exclusive, maybe. But that's a great choice, Joe, and it is something that I've like thought about at the back of my mind, but I totally didn't think about it for this topic. Okay, so my first choice, and I don't know, maybe I'm going about this a different way than you guys are, and that's fine, because my first choice is actually something where I knew the word before, but it's being used in a different way than I had heard it before, and possibly in a different way than Star Trek fans had heard it before. So, this first comes up in The Best of Both Worlds Part 2, basically where you see Locutus and Riker talking to each other. You know, eventually Locutus says, "Discussion is irrelevant. There are no terms. You will disarm all your weapons and escort us to Sector 001, where we will begin assimilating your culture and technology." And it's specifically the word assimilate or assimilating. Because, like, if you take a look at the dictionary definition of assimilation, it says process of taking in and fully understanding information or ideas, or absorption and integration of people, ideas, or culture into a wider society or culture. And I think I had an idea of those kinds of senses. But Star Trek with the Borg, and starting with Best of Both Worlds, takes it to another level where it's not just, like, absorb, like, when you think about the process of assimilation, which I know can be a very controversial topic, as far as like people and cultures, it's kind of adjusting things to kind of fit the culture that you're a part of, possibly leaving behind other traditions and things like that. But in the case of the Borg, it's like your entire identity and free will are subsumed or assimilated into the Borg collective. So it made me think of this word in a different way ever afterward. So that was my first choice. What do you guys think?
I think I'm the opposite to that. I had never heard the word before.
Oh,
but
okay.
Since, obviously, so my first knowledge about the word assimilation was purely from Star Trek, where they're going to basically take all your best bits and like kind of bring you into their society and make you copies of themselves. But now, given the kind of the world's a lot smaller and you know about, I've learned about examples of assimilation in other cultures, like in the UK over the last decade or so, there's been lots of economic migrants into the country and there are issues with their assimilation into the kind of British culture, I suppose. Is there a requirement to assimilate? And I think there's some US examples as well.
We've had quite the history on that one. Yes. For sure.
Yeah. Also here in Canada, it's not really spoken about, but it's here as well. I guess it's like a worldly type of, it's human nature, I think, right? When you have groups of people migrating around.
Yeah. I take it in the US and Canada, it's about indigenous populations not assimilating into Western culture.
Well, I mean, it certainly, like, I can only speak for the US. I guess it was the case in Canada as well. But yeah, that's kind of how it started. Europeans coming in, mm-hmm. and the native or indigenous populations, in some cases, being forced to adjust or assimilate into the prevailing, you know, European influence culture. But it also, at least I know in the US over time, as different groups of immigrants have come from, you know, different parts of Europe, but then also from Asia and Africa and all over the world, there have been these things that have happened where over time, like through the generations, you know, people are kind of adjusting to more and more of the American culture. Like for my ancestors, my dad's side of the family, they were Eastern European Jews that came in the late 19th century. And for my mom's side of the family, they were from Southern Italy in the 19th century. And of course, when they came here, they spoke a different language. They had, you know, different religion and culture than a lot of the people around them. But definitely, like, as I looked at my family history, generation to generation, people were more, you know, speaking English, thinking of themselves as American, not as much adhering to the religion or the traditions. And I mean, for me, since my mom and my dad came from these like different cultures, like I think of the things that come from those cultures, but it's not actually like a really big part of my life, like 130 years later or something like that, right? So that does change as you're there generation after generation oftentimes, although not always, I think. So that I can only speak for the US, maybe it's different in Canada. But
right, that's something I can speak on like a personal level, being first gen here, being born here, and like my parents being from Pakistan, India. So that's for sure. Like I see myself, and that's what our parents will say, oh, you guys are losing the culture, losing the language. You guys are veering away from religion, right? And then we'll see like my kids and so on and so forth. They'll start to assimilate further into the culture here.
Yeah. And I mean, I think part of it is like, if you're exposed more on like a daily basis to this other culture instead of the culture of your parents or your aunts, I mean, of course it influences you, right? And the people that you know and work with and go to school with like may be a part of this culture or influence you in that way. I think it can just happen, right? Yeah.
So I was not thinking that when we talk about culture, like Western culture, and we're treating it as some kind of monolithic, unchanging entity. And I think we should be looking at it as something like cultures are enriched by immigration and people bringing aspects of their culture. So sure, I'm thinking that by you coming to like, or your family, your parents coming from Pakistan, they would have brought aspects of like Pakistani culture into Canada, and that would have thereby enriched the life of Canada as a nation.
Right. Yeah, that's right. And here, particularly in the Toronto area, it's very cosmopolitan and like international. So you have all the different types of foods here. People have their own restaurants. They will speak their own languages. A lot of people won't learn English for that reason. So even our like even the government text that you'll find in manuals and even at the government facilities, you'll have posters saying welcome in like 50 different languages. You'll have
yes.
books. Yeah. People can, if they speak Cantonese or Mandarin, you can find that. It's readily available. Even in Arabic or Urdu, like they speak in Pakistan, for example. So it's like the societies learn to, I wouldn't say assimilate, but to allow people to process themselves into their environment in a really smooth manner, and to slowly get themselves to a point where they feel comfortable speaking English and communicating with others here.
Yeah. No, I mean, Joe, it's a really good point. I mean, I definitely believe that the different cultures that come into other countries, like into the US or Canada, or no, in the UK, like I think it does enrich that culture and add something to have all of that diversity. I was just speaking in terms of what's tended to happen, at least in the US over time, that the people that are here generation after generation are somewhat less connected to that culture. And actually where I live in El Paso, Texas is an interesting example because, you know, the vast majority of the people here are of Mexican descent. I mean, some people have lived here generation after generation, but because Mexico's right across the border, there's still an extremely strong influence from the Mexican culture. And in some ways, some places, the only difference really is that like the signs are in English, right? But it's kind of like a similar feeling to being across the border in Mexico. So there are places like this, I think, where in some ways more the Mexican culture is more dominant than the American culture, which is pretty interesting.
That's interesting. It's interesting for me, growing up where I grew up, near Glasgow, when I went to school, both primary school and high school, it was all white Scottish kids that went there. My first experience of anybody from anywhere else was when I went to university. And I made friends with like people. There was a guy who he was of Chinese descent. His parents were Chinese, and a girl who was of Indian descent. And so it just kind of opened this kind of new world. And it was nothing to do with the people I chose to hang about with. It just, there wasn't anybody available of that wasn't white. And I think my life was more enriched by having access to all these different cultures and different kind of ways of thinking and different ideas, which is much cooler. And then we come to STLV and there's people from everywhere, which is amazing.
Yeah, all over the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's go on to our second picks. So, Shoaib, let's have your second pick.
Okay, my second pick is from Parallels, Season 7, Episode 11. When Data's talking about quantum fissures, he's describing the whole situation with the quantum realities. And there's a short quote of his. It goes, "For any event, there's an infinite number of possible outcomes. Our choices determine which outcomes will follow. But there is a theory in quantum physics that all possibilities that can happen do happen in alternate quantum realities." And when I heard this, I still remember it for some reason, this episode. In 94, I was 6.5, 7 years old.
Oh, wow.
So just being a sponge, hearing everything I'm hearing and watching on TV just soaked in. But this, I was like, what is this concept and what's going on, right? The whole episode's a jumble of different details that change, right? And then you have poor Worf going through phases, just seeing things change as the episode progresses. And this moment when Data's explaining it in this manner, I was like, wow, that's possible, that there's whatever I'm doing right now could be different in a different place somehow. Mm. Right. And that, mm-hmm. and that there's multiple versions of me and I'm just sitting there like, what, what's going on? And yeah, so it's that kind of opened up my mind to these amazing concepts, right. In science and physics that I never would have thought about outside of Star Trek.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably a very mind-blowing thing if you're 6 or 7 to think about, right?
Yeah, yeah. And then I remember, because my eldest brother's 10 years older than me. So I remember asking him, what does all this mean? What's going on? Like, why is Worf changing and where's Captain Picard? Because right? Near the end of the episode and in the last few scenes, it's Picard is, in that reality, he was gone. And I was like, what's going on? What happened to him? Like, oh, don't worry, he'll be back. It's just a different reality. I'm like, what does that mean? But yeah.
I mean, and it's a concept that still in some ways is a little hard to understand because we haven't actually like had the physical experience of what that's like. But it is based on a real thing. I mean, there is a many worlds interpretation of quantum physics,
right,
to try to make some of that work. So it could very well be that there's all of these kind of branching realities based on all of the decisions that are made and all possible things are actually happening, which kind of blows my mind. Like, where do all the energy come for that? But, right. but yeah, it's a very mind expanding concept. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Joe?
That's really interesting because that's an example I use in teaching all the time because I teach physics. And when you're talking to the pupils about the scale of the universe now, and I always get them to write their address but be as specific as possible, and they always kind of stop at their town, but they don't say like what country or what continent, and they don't say the Earth and it's the third planet of the solar system and kind of the whatever arm of the Milky Way galaxy. And then you just progress, when you're talking to them you progressively get bigger and bigger and bigger. And then somebody invariably asks the question about kind of multiple universes or kind of infinite dimensions. And so I show them that wee clip of Data doing his little explanation with the animated graphic where
his little splits PowerPoint.
splits off into multiple branches. That's one of the examples that I use in teaching all the time. So that's pretty cool. There are loads of examples, actually. I noticed Amy is a big fan of like using Star Trek in teaching, and I thought I don't think I'd really do it half as much as I should because I've taken a lot from Star Trek over the years, so I probably should use what I've taken from it.
You host a Star Trek podcast now, so you have got to use it more in your teaching.
I'm a famous podcaster now. I know. I really should. But it was making me think of examples where I do the same. And there's the line that Data says about the burning the midnight oil. And the line is, what is the etymology of that idiom? And I think in teaching, etymology is a really useful thing. Because if you've got like an obscure concept, if you can explain to the pupils where certain words came from, and a prime example is when you're teaching about electrical circuits and you're teaching about like current and charge, and why does charge have the symbol I, and no, charge is the symbol, I'm getting it wrong, I'm failing at being a teacher, charge is the symbol Q and current has the symbol I, and like, they just get confused over that. So you give them the context of that, okay, it was a French scientist, it was Ampère and Coulomb that did the experiments with it. And when they were talking about it, they were speaking French. So Ampère spoke about the intensity of the current. So he gave it the symbol I, and now we just call it current. And Coulomb talked about the quantization of charge or the quantity of the charge, so gave it the symbol Q. So there's lots, that word etymology that Data used has stuck with me forever. And I just always, I think I've got a really kind of passionate passing interest in etymology now, just because of Star Trek.
That's something that I can sympathize with. I'm also that kind of weirdo who will sit there listening to people talk. But wait, where did that phrase come from?
Yeah.
Right? And I'll ask them, what's the history of the phrase? Mm-hmm. Or I'll at least go back and I'll try to note it down and try to figure out, what does that mean? Like, how I drive my wife nuts. I'm like, let me Google this, figure out where it came from. She's like, oh my God, not again. You're going to search another term and tell me the history of it. And
I love finding out the history of how stuff got to be the way it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, very cool. All right, so Joe, your second pick.
Oh, second pick. Okay, can we have to? It's in the kind of show outline almost. It's like Shakespeare. I think we can't talk about language in Star Trek without talking about Shakespeare. And the prime example, it's not only Shakespeare, it's from Ménage à Trois, where Picard is trying to win.
Oh, you've got to do it melodramatically, Joe. You've got to read it melodramatically.
Do you know what? Actually, I was practicing it earlier, and it's like the worst Patrick Stewart ever. I'd be ashamed, but I will do it for you guys.
Yeah, but it's intentionally bad.
Yeah,
don't worry, Joe. You'll only be telling. It's just between the three of us, right?
Yeah, nobody else is going to hear this.
No, nobody. No, just our listeners in the Czech Republic and Hungary. all three of them. Okay, so Picard is trying to win back the love of Lwaxana Troi, who's been held captive by some Ferengi daemon on his ship. And he just goes into a series of Shakespeare sonnets, a variety of different sonnets, until he's interrupted by the daemon. So here goes nothing. My love is a fever, longing still for that which longer nurseth the disease. In faith, I do not love these with mine eyes, for they and thee a thousand errors see. But 'tis my heart that loves what they despise, who, in despite of you, are pleased to doubt. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and temperate. So, yeah.
Bravo. Encore.
Yeah, that was great, Joe, although maybe it was kind of a mix between your Picard and your Admiral Sati.
Quite possibly, yes.
But I love that. It's great. But you didn't do the gesture where he's like, oh, holding his
arm
out.
He does that whole, it's this really melodramatic pose that he starts out with as if he's going to go into his, like, because he's a stage actor.
Which has become the famous meme where his hands are outstretched and people just put random blurbs underneath it.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And then he goes into, 'tis better to have loved and lost than to never have loved at all, which isn't Shakespeare. It's Tennyson.
Okay.
See, even someone who's as like well read and well rounded as Picard can go on tangents while speaking Shakespeare.
Yeah, it's genius. And then the best use of Shakespeare, not in that episode, in Deja Q, where he quotes Hamlet, and he's talking to Q, about humanity and like the future of humans. And he says, I do have to do it in the accent again and the really bad Admiral Satie voice.
Okay, it's your go-to.
Okay. He's got gravitas here, so it's not like he's trying to win the Wixana voice. What he said with irony, I say with conviction. What a piece of work is man, how noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in form, in moving, how express and admirable, in action, how like an angel, in apprehension, how like a god.
Bravo.
Fantastic.
Is that better? Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Love it.
I love it.
So it's that kind of, it's really floral language.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the English we use today. And when I say English we use today, it's like what we're all using. And I know, like, Justin, you'll be speaking American English and I'm speaking whatever English I speak. And Schwab, I don't know. You're speaking
I'll be using
English.
Canadian yes. English. Hey.
Yes. Okay. Yes. That made me think, obviously, Shakespeare wrote in the language of the time, like a few hundred years ago. And we are like, 300-400 years separated from that,
400 years.
400
yeah.
years. So Star Trek The Next Generation is like 400 years almost from now. So how is the language going to change?
Right, but it hasn't much. And that's the interesting thing about Star Trek, because if you look back at it, like if you look at the original series, in a way, they're speaking how people would in the 1960s, because I notice sometimes there are certain phrases or ways of like having exclamations or doing things that feels very of that time. And then if you go into like the 80s and 90s, there's something very particular about it. And if you go forward, so it's very much the language of whenever they're really making this thing. But I'm sure hundreds of years from now, it might be as different as like Shakespeare is to us. Although there is a case to be made that because we have like a system of global communications, that it might be that some languages may stay more stable over time. I don't know, though, because there is all kinds of slang and things that come in all the time that change the language. There's all kinds of things in our conversation that somebody 30 years ago would know what the heck we were talking about.
Right. Or how we use like the in our text messages, these short forms that abbreviated LOL and LMAO. And
yeah, somebody looking at that like 30 years ago would be like, what does that mean? What are you talking about?
Yeah. And then you like even have kids these days, they're... I'm saying kids these days, but I'm...
Those kids these days.
but they speak using emojis. I think I'm just past that age, right? But if I was maybe 5-6 years younger, I'd probably be doing that too. But just emojis they're speaking with. And that's its own language too, right?
Yeah. Or it's like when abbreviations like LOL and FOMO become actual words.
Right.
And so people might say LOL instead of actually laughing.
Right.
Which
yeah,
you probably
exactly.
should do if you're laughing out loud.
It would be so interesting to project like 50 years into the future if people were just using things that are like little abbreviations or emojis and see what that podcast would be like.
Yeah.
That might be difficult, but
but it's that's a hangover from when Twitter only allowed you to use like 120 characters in messages.
No, it's not just that, because I remember when I was first like doing instant messaging. This was probably when I was in college in like the 97, 98. Like there wasn't really a limit to what you could put in the box or what you could say, I think, but you would use all of these abbreviations because you'd want to get across things really quickly, because you'd want to type something out before the other person typed it out. So you'd have like this conversation that would make sense.
Oh, okay.
So there was, because of like the instant written communication, there became an incentive for using abbreviations and leaving out certain words and putting like the letter U instead of YOU and stuff like that, because you'd want to type it out quickly. And sometimes also I remember back then, like you would have multiple conversations going on at the same time. So you'd have like 3 or 4 chat windows and you'd be like, over here, over here, over here. I mean, it would just be like crazy how quickly you'd have to do stuff. So I think it came from that and not really from any like actual limitation, but from having to type things out really quickly.
There's maybe then an argument to say that just now earlier you said that globally some languages might stay more stable.
Hmm.
There might be an argument that languages might change quicker because of world influences. But like, I think in 100 years' time, they will be, if they're speaking English, it will be pretty much unintelligible. There'll be little snippets. There'll be like, if you're Spanish trying to listen to a Portuguese person, they're very similar languages, but they'll be completely different. It'll just have evolved very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, that could very well be. It is really interesting because you think about language and you can watch stuff even in Star Trek from like 50 years ago and you know what's going on, right? Mm-hmm. You really know what they're talking about. Just there's certain words or things where you're like, huh, people don't really talk like that anymore, but I kind of know what they're saying. But yeah, if you go forward further on, I'm sure it'll be the case that it would be difficult to understand. Or like what happens with Shakespeare, like if you read something that's like kind of a version where it tells you like, okay, this word means this and they mean this and here's the history of that. Because like if you as like a modern English speaker just try to read Shakespeare without having the notes or understanding some of the words, it's kind of hard to follow, isn't it? I think at least. So when I was in high school, it was great that we had those books where it would be like little notes like this means this and here's the history, here's why he's talking about that, here's the event that was going on then, you know, that kind of stuff.
You have like the footnotes, right? I guess I was thinking about this last day. Star Trek has its own kind of the lexicon, right? It's its own dictionary. And literally they'll have words and phrases which they have to use often because that creates that world and it gives it that realism which we as fans were just clinging to, right?
Like subspace, right? Kind of made that up for Star Trek, but and it means something very particular, but it's a word that was kind of created for Star Trek.
You have warp drive, warp speed, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. It does. There is its own like Star Trek language that I'm sure somebody just dropping into a random episode who's not a Star Trek fan has never seen it might be like, what is that? Why are they talking that way? Right. You know, yeah. But we've gotten used to it.
Yeah, and you hear somebody like, oh, we have to release the drive plasma and the plasma inducers are failing and yada, yada, yada. And we're like, oh, wow. Oh, they're going to die, blah, blah, blah. And everyone else is like, what are they talking about?
Like, what is gibberish. Why are they reversing the polarity?
Yeah, yeah. Try reversing the polarity.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. So that's a great pick, Joe. I mean, Shakespeare is just a classic Star Trek influence. So for my second pick, I'll have to think about this because, okay. So here's like a specific example. I'll see what you guys think. It's actually from one of my favorite early TNG episodes where no one has gone before, which is the first one with the Traveler and where they're going these incredible distances, right? And something that kind of expanded my mind at the time that I was seeing it was kind of the way the Traveler was talking about these things. So I'm just going to read out the scene between Wesley and the Traveler. So Wesley says, what happened to you? Is it part of what happened to the ship? And the Traveler says, please believe me, I mean no harm to this vessel or those in it. Is Mr. Kaczynski like he sounds, a joke? No, that's too cruel. He has sensed some small part of it. And Wesley says that space and time and thought aren't the separate things they appear to be. I just thought the formula you were using said something like that. And the Traveler says, boy, don't ever say that again, and especially not at your age in a world that's not ready for such dangerous nonsense. So like what I took out of that scene is, so first of all, like space and time not being separate, that's actually part of Einstein's theories of relativity. We know that space-time is like an integrated thing and not really separate. But in this episode, it's positing that thought isn't separate from that as well, that thought can really be an integral part and influence space-time and what you can do and where you can travel. So there was just something about the language, the way that they were talking about that and talking about the power of thought being able to like have an important influence on space-time that I think that was one of the first TNG episodes where I was like, wow, that's really something that they're putting forward there. And they also travel like a billion light years or something, which kind of blew my mind. So there was just a little something about that and how they described it. It wasn't just seeing it, but it was actually talking about like the merging of space and time and thought that really kind of expanded the way I think about things.
The Traveler is almost, there's something mystical about him. Yeah. Like he's a seer. Like if it was a fantasy show, he'd be like some kind of old woman with a crystal ball. And he's got that kind of magical way about him. And the language definitely conveys that sense that he's connected to some other world somewhere. And it kind of reminds me of the aliens from the movie Arrival with Amy Adams. Yeah. If you've seen that, where it's all about Yeah, it's all about communication in that movie. So he's definitely a bit strange.
Yeah, he's like a ethereal sort of prophet type of thing, right?
That's the word. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. He's there, but he's not really there. Mm-hmm. And just even the way he speaks, he's like, "Oh, this is just a place where I'm traveling through." Literally, he's a traveler. He's on to the next, ascending to the next plateau of reality, or maybe he's crossing between, you know, thresholds of reality.
I mean, and like this concept of thought really influencing like space and time and things that happen. I mean, it gets picked up in different parts of Star Trek. I actually think particularly, because I'm doing a Voyager rewatch of what happens to Kes, I think in The Gift before she leaves, where basically she has these mental powers that that Tuvok is helping her with, but it gets to the point where she's like using her thoughts to like dig deeply into like the subatomic structure of things and starts like melting things and just like warping the ship and all this stuff. So that gets picked up in different parts of Star Trek. And I think it is interesting in a show like Star Trek that very much like, I think, tries to be science-based, that there are these parts where they talk about things like telepathy and the power of thought that you might not at first glance think. I mean, Star Trek kind of takes that as a given. Like, there are people that can really read other people's thoughts. There are people whose thoughts can really, like, influence the real world. It kind of, like, accepts that as, like, a scientific reality of the time, but it's far from proven at this point. But I've always found that kind of interesting because it has that element that goes, I think, fairly far beyond what's been confirmed in science right now.
That was deep, Justin.
Yeah, just hearing you say that about how humans transcend their physical, you know, abilities. It's like the episode where no man has gone before in the original series,
in
TOS, right?
Yeah,
right, where they crossed the barrier and they became superhuman, right? So
yeah.
Yeah, so that's been around since the beginning of Trek. So.
Yeah, and all the godlike beings and powers in the original series. I mean, there are things that are going on where it does seem like us, like it's magic, yeah. Right? that's happening. But for them, like, this is reality. And it would be pretty interesting if in a few hundred years that is really part of the reality and we accept that. Yeah. So anyway, those kinds of things like bend my mind, like, okay, if you think about something like warp drive, all right, you can have like a scientific theory around it and think about how you might do that and impulse engines and whatever. But when you're thinking of the power of thought, like, we don't have any kind of coherent like scientific theory that would say that should be the case, that it would have that kind of influence. So
yeah, I suppose this is where you get into like the metaphysics, right? So yeah. Metatrix, obviously. They're showing the network for that. So
I'm trying to form a thought here, yeah? Coherent thought about.
Okay, don't melt me.
Sorry, too far away. My powers don't extend to that.
Oh, okay. That limited range. That's good.
So there's something about the way the brain operates, how it's how it communicates with itself, and that it's all electrical impulses. And so there's lots of electromagnetic fields around everything the brain does, and in technology we use electromagnetic fields to manipulate things and allow electrical circuits to work. And you think about how MRI machines operate, and they have the ability to remotely basically read the structure of the brain based on kind of magnetic dipoles. So I don't see why in the future we wouldn't be able to have some kind of thought, some kind of technological telepathy or telekinesis.
So you're saying that we just need to figure out how to be a human MRI machine?
Kinda, yeah.
Kinda, yeah. Okay.
I think there's a bit of a leap, and obviously we don't understand the way the brain works fully.
See, that's the thing. Maybe if we understood fully how the brain works, there would be ways to be able to harness that in a different way. Who knows? Wow. Okay. Some really interesting discussions we're having. All right. So, Shoaib, your third pick.
Okay. So this is one of my favorite episodes of Star Trek in general. I think it's a very popular one. Season 5, episode 19, The First Duty. And it's particularly the scene in the Red Room with Captain Picard when he's confronting Wesley after they've discovered the truth of the Cobalt Star that they were going to perform those cadet pilots.
Oh, the maneuver. Yeah.
So I have the little quote here. It's from when he was dressing down Wesley, basically. And okay, I'm going to try my Picard here.
Okay, go for
okay.
it.
The first duty of every Starfleet officer is to the truth, be it scientific truth, historical truth, or personal truth. It is the guiding principle upon which Starfleet is based. If you cannot find it within yourself to stand up and tell the truth about what happened, you do not deserve to wear that uniform. Mr. Crusher, I'll make this simple for you. Either you come forward and tell Admiral Brand what really took place, or I will. And that scene, as a kid...
Hey, good Picard. That's better
like,
than I could do.
Oh, snap. Like, he's... Wesley's in trouble, and this is really serious. Like, I could tell by the tone. Obviously, Picard is amazing. I mean, Patrick Stewart's portrayal is fantastic. And you feel, like the gravity of how... I guess the word would be disappointment in Wesley, right? He was feeling so like the let down by him. Yeah, it's kind of, I learned from this the importance of communicating one's intention. Like Picard knew what he had to tell him, and he wasn't going to force him, but in the same, he was kind of giving him an ultimatum with this statement that I am compelling you as much as I can, knowing you for all these years, to go and tell the truth to the panel, or I will.
It's great, and what I love there is that he's talking about different kinds of truth, right? Yeah. Like oftentimes we talk about the truth, right? But he's talking about whether it's scientific truth or historical truth or personal truth, that there are different kinds of truths and different things, like, and you have to be faithful to all of those things. And I think it's great that he makes that distinction, like, there's not just like the truth. There are these different sections and you have to be faithful to all of those things. And I think that's really a powerful way to put it and makes you think about it in a different way than if you just said the truth, right?
Right. And it sort of gives that wonderful nuance to even the title of the episode, The First Duty, right? He says it in this quote, which is great, but that just adds like another layer of nuance and gravitas to the situation. Because he's making it more than just serving the Federation. It's about yourself, and what do you mean? What's your intention, right?
And he's not talking with Wesley like you violated a regulation. He's like, you violated the first and most important thing that's part of your duty.
It's sort of like a unspoken, you know, knowledge, right? You don't really have to talk about it, but he's like, kid, you don't know what you're doing, but yeah, you have to strain up now and I'm going to tell you how to.
Yeah. Oh, very good. What do you think, Joe?
There's obviously a lot more depth to that quote than I'd previously seen. I think it's a really good example of like all the good dialogue being given to Patrick Stewart, or maybe not. Maybe it's the case that Patrick Stewart's just such a phenomenal actor that he does magic with what he's given.
It's both, though. I mean, Patrick Stewart is an amazing actor, but if somebody wrote something for him that wasn't very good, I mean, it requires both. And I think the writing there is really good. And when you have someone who can perform it at the highest level, it just like elevates it so much. I think it's both kind of working together hand in hand. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So, Joe, your third pick.
Yeah. Well, we do some technobabble. I know that we kind of mentioned technobabble.
I'd say go for it because my last pick doesn't have to really do with that.
So I think the best example of made up gibberish, I didn't even get the name of the episode. What's the episode where the Ferengis take over the ship and Picard and Guinan and Keiko?
That's
Rascals.
Rascals, yeah. So my third pick is from the episode Rascals, and it's the most genius gibberish technobabble that you could ever possibly have heard.
I know what you're about to say.
Yes, I have quoted this before on a recent roundtable, a patrons roundtable. Riker is telling the Ferengi Morta how the computer works and how the Enterprise operates. And he says, I'm not even going to try a Riker because my American accent will be offensive. It'll be offensive.
It's an alternate universe Scottish Riker.
Sure, okay. Mick Riker, we'll call him. Computer, release command control to the station. Authorization, Riker Omega-3. Okay, Morta. The Enterprise computer system is controlled by three primary main processing cores cross-linked with a redundant Mellicorts Ramistat and 14 kiloquad interface modules. The core elements are based on FTL nanoprocessor units arranged into 25 bilateral kiloelectrodes, with 20 of those units being slaved to the central Heisenfram terminal. You do know what a bilateral kiloelectrode is, don't you? Morta says, of course I do, human. I am not stupid. Then Riker goes on, no, of course not. Now, this is the isopalavial interface which controls the main firomactyl drive unit. Don't touch that. You'll blow up the entire firomactyl drive. Morta, what? Wait, what is? What is a firomactyl? Just explain it to me. Riker, oh, sigh. That is the firomactyl drive unit. It controls the central Ramistat core and also keeps the Ontarian manifold within 40,000 KRG. It's just...
I love that scene. Yes.
There are snippets of things that make sense. Like a Heisenfram terminal sounds a bit like Heisenberg compensator. So you can kind of buy it.
There is one thing in there that's real, though, which is he talks, well, not real like we have it in our world, but real in the Star Trek world. He talks about an FTL nanoprocessor. FTL means faster than light, and they do have faster than light processors in their computers, although I don't know if they really truly confirm that on screen, but they definitely have that in the books.
I was under the impression that the optical data network on Starfleet vessels where it was surrounded by subspace fields to enable fast and light communications. I mean, I thought everybody knew this.
That's news to me.
Yeah, they never say that on screen, but that makes perfect sense. At least I don't think they say it on screen, but that makes perfect sense.
It does make perfect sense.
It does.
So is Riker making this stuff up, or are those actual like technical principles for the computer?
I think he's making it up.
He's really good at making this stuff up.
Well, it's just made up stuff, isn't it?
It's his verbal version of the poker face, right? Because remember, he was talking to him on one side, and then his other hand was off to the other end of the console.
Oh, okay.
And he was giving the nursery access, right, where Picard and them were.
Yeah, yeah.
So, see, Justin, the point is, like, if I take some tadactardine, and put it in a cup with some millicarnanorts, and then heat it up in the ruminogenoma, it's going to make a bomb and blow everybody up. So it's easy.
See, you're better at it than I am, because I'd find it hard to make that stuff up. But you made up some great fake technobabble.
Yeah, it's just like I generally in everyday life talk nonsense, so it just comes naturally.
You should do that to your students once and pretend you're teaching like a physical principle and just make up some stuff and see if they notice.
I once taught kids that when rats get to a certain age, they find somewhere quiet and dark, deep under the earth, and they go into a cocoon. And then after like a couple of months, they emerge from the cocoon as pigeons. Which is why pigeons are called flying rats. And it wasn't a science class, so I didn't feel so bad. But I'd never corrected it.
Did anyone believe it?
Well, they were like young, they were 12, so yes, and I've never corrected it.
Oh my God, you corrupted those 12-year-olds.
Yes. Please, if you're listening, do not contact the GTCS, which is my professional body, and report me.
Wow.
So, Mr. Keegan made me believe that rats turn into pigeons.
Same here. I'm just as guilty, Justin.
That's true, damn it.
No, but that's a great pick. I mean, there is some really crazy technobabble in Star Trek, and that's right up there with the best of it.
Yeah.
And again, the writers like writing something. I mean, apparently they have the same affinity for it as you do, Joe, just to make up stuff.
Indeed.
But yeah, it's pretty great.
Cool.
Okay. So my third pick. So, and this was one actually, I didn't include it in the description in the episode, but Shrub, I think you included this as an example. So I'm surprised it hasn't come up yet. But it is probably one of the preeminent examples in Star Trek of the power of words and language. And it's got to be Darmok. I'm wearing my Darmok shirt as well. So it's got to be Darmok because, I mean, that is the episode for me more than any other that really expands my mind about how language can be used and how trying to understand a really difficult usage of language can lead to positive communication and relations. So, I mean, of course, in the episode, they can understand the words that these Temerians are saying, but the way that it's constructed together, they have no idea what it actually means, even though, like, through the Universal Translator, they're, you know, Federation standard words. So what I wanted to do, because Memory Alpha has it here, is just read some examples of the Temerian language, because I think what they come up with, where it's based on like allegory and stories, is just so super interesting. So I'll kind of go over what it has here. I think it's in alphabetical order, but different things that are talked about in the episode. So the beast at Tanagra, children of Tama, Chenza at court, the court of silence, Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra, Darmok and Jalad on the ocean, Darmok on the ocean, Picard and Dathan at Eladrel, Kadir beneath Momete, Kailash when it rises, Kiazi's children, their faces wet, Kira at Bashi, Kateo, his eyes closed, Mirab with sails unfurled, Ryan Jiri at Lunga, Rai of Luani, Luani under two moons, Jiri of Ubaya, Ubaya at the crossroads, at Lunga, Lunga her sky gray, the river to mark in winter, Shaka when the walls fell, Sokath his eyes opened, Temba at rest, Temba his arms open, Uzani his army with fists closed, Uzani his army with fists open, Zima at Anzo, Zima and Bakor, Zinda, his face black, his eyes red. So I think that's most of the Temerian that's spoken in the show. And it's just interesting to like hear those things and not have the context. I mean, there's certain ones we know, right? We know what Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra means. We know what, you know, Picard and Dathan at Eladrel, or Shaka when the walls fell. But there's a lot of the other ones where it's like, what did they mean by that? And there's some interpretations on Memory Alpha, but I just love like hearing it. And in the episode, when you hear someone speaking these kind of allegorical words and these stories that are behind it, I think there's something very beautiful and very like interesting about it and elegant about it, even if at the beginning of the episode, we have no idea what they're saying. So that had to be my third pick. What do you guys think?
Justin, his stories awakening. Yeah, I didn't know there was half as much as what you just said there. Because obviously all that isn't in the episode. It's been added to, is that right?
No, all of this is in the episode in different places, yeah.
Ah, okay, wow. Oops.
I mean, especially toward the beginning, because when they're having the back and forth, there's a lot of Temerian that they're speaking. But yeah, okay. Those are things that are actually from the episode. There's a couple variations even that I didn't read. There are a couple word variations, but that's all in the episode.
And it's really interesting. You don't have to understand to get the gist of what's been said, really. You quickly become familiar with what the Temerian captain's trying to get at without understanding the meaning of the individual
eventually
phrases.
But I think the first time you really don't.
Yeah, interesting. It's like I read an article earlier, or like sped read it, that said that a language like that would not work.
Oh, they've done some work on that in the books. You want to hear what the solution
is? Yes. Who knew there was a book?
Yes, please.
Go for it.
Well, yeah. So I think there could be issues with it because it's referencing things that have to otherwise be told in more of the prose that we're used to. But I think that the idea, oh, now I'm trying to remember how it goes about. Well, first of all, there is actually a separate like scientific language that they have, because you couldn't really do science with that kind of language. So apparently like for science and some other things, there's kind of like a separate language that they have. But when they're conversing with each other, the idea is that when the kids are growing up, the parents are kind of teaching them these things, and they are, you know, in some way through other means telling their children like what these stories really mean, like acting it out or something like that, or some other means, so that they know what those things like actually mean, but that they again do have a different language for other things where just talking in allegory, like when you're doing science, it wouldn't really be helpful. So
it's like conversational Temerian.
Yeah.
It's not what like Google Translate would give you, which is like proper Temerian, like
yeah, it'd be from like a textbook or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe you could think of it that way, but like, I mean, regardless of the potential issues, I think the idea that people could think about communicating in such a different way was one that just like opened my mind, because, you know, we think about we're on Earth and we have all of these different languages that to a large extent really go like back toward the same roots like many thousands of years ago. But if you're talking about beings that are on other worlds that wouldn't have the common roots, it's kind of surprising in Star Trek that it's so often you can kind of understand the syntax, because you'd think there would be languages out there that would be so incredibly alien to try to understand, and they have different ways of thinking about things and different values and different historical experiences and whatnot that would lead to something that would be really different. I guess you could say in the chase that because there's this common origin among these humanoid species, but even the ones that don't have that common origin, and even if you do, like how language would be implanted in your DNA doesn't really make any sense. But yeah, like I think what we usually see in Star Trek outside of Darmok is far more understandable than it seems like it should be, right?
Right. I think that's just a function of it working for the audience, right? Otherwise, we would just spend half the episodes trying to interpret the other aliens, right?
Yeah, but there are other examples, like an Enterprise's silent enemy. Like, they don't really get to communicate with that species at all. Like, they have no idea what's going on, why they're being attacked. There's, like, no communication, maybe because it's just not understandable to them. So there's, like, a few, but you're right. For convenience, a lot of times, to get the story going or get the point across, you have to assume that they kind of speak in the same way and think about things kind of in the same way, and that you can like actually translate between the two.
Yeah, and then I guess that's where the UT is such a important invention in the world of Star Trek, right? Universal Translator. This was something I was obviously thinking of using from one of my picks, but it's so obvious, so I thought, you know, just delve into the episodes and find some different examples. Yeah,
I usually leave the obvious ones for the end, seeing if anyone else chooses them, and then I'll put them in, because if we didn't talk about Darmok,
it would be, be a missed opportunity. I agree. Yeah.
So
I don't think the universal translator will ever exist.
In what way are you saying that? Are you just talking about, or like even on for Earth languages, or just for other ones that?
Oh no, Earth language is easy because we have knowledge of the syntax and the grammar and how the languages are constructed. So like Google Translate does it relatively well. And you get more instantaneous versions where you just speak into it and it directly translates it. But in terms of alien languages, it depends on what you think aliens, how they might be constructed and have evolved. There's kind of theories out there where if aliens evolved on kind of Earth-like planets, then they would have roughly the same elements available, and so the biological and organic matter would be formed from the same things, so evolution might be similar. However, I'm thinking about like birds. You've heard like birds of paradise, birds in general have two bronchial passages, so they can make multiple tones at the same time, which is something we can't do. So I'm thinking if birds were to have evolved to become kind of intelligent and technological, then their speech patterns would be wildly different. So I don't see that we could have a machine that just naturally understands an alien language without understanding the rules of that language.
Yeah, well, and I think the idea when they do explain it is like the universal translator is really good at just constructing the rules of their language based on just hearing a little bit. But that does seem like it would be really difficult. Mm. I think it would be much more likely that something would happen, you know, like has happened before when people meet and they don't know each other's language. They would start trying to communicate by like maybe gesturing to certain things and saying like, this is rock and, you know, all this stuff to try to get there. And that has happened, you know, in the past when different cultures have met. So I would think that kind of thing would happen. There would be someone or some people that would learn that alien's language, and the alien might learn our language or whichever language that they're encountering. And then from there, then you can be able to put in the information into a universal translator to use it going forward. I think that's more likely, right?
I was thinking, like, even a language in itself, we always, it's all a matter of perspective, right? We're fortunate as human beings, we have a similar perspective and matter of perception. So the way we see the world is very similar. Like if I see red, 99% of my fellow humans are going to see red.
Yeah.
And we can say, okay, we can say definitively this color's red, this one's blue, this one's green. And then we can start to create categories and differentiate things and, you know, go about our business and talk about stuff, right? And communicate. But if you're talking about alien races, you don't know if they can perceive things, if they even see, if they have eyes the way we do, because we have a very limited spectrum of light, which we can perceive ourselves, right?
That's true. And I think that's kind of influenced by the light of the sun and what wavelengths that it comes in at. Maybe an alien is coming from a planet that's around a different star that has different wavelengths of light that are being emitted as like visible light to them. And so maybe they would perceive color differently or their surroundings. Yeah, I mean, we just don't know, but I think it's likely that it would be different in some way, right?
Yeah, or how we have like the animals with like the echolocation, something like that. You don't know if they can even perceive things in a physical form like that with eyes.
Hmm. Yeah.
There's the thing about our perception of light on Earth. Yes, Justin, like from the spectral type of the star, given out various wavelengths, but also how much of that visible radiation is absorbed by the atmosphere changes the light that you see. So it depends on your star, but also the atmosphere that you're in. And there's the weird species on Earth, like dogs see kind of differently. It's like I think it's almost like black and white with some little bits of color that dogs see, and they don't have very good distance vision. And then there's things that have evolved deep in the ocean where there is no light, but they've evolved to produce their own light, and they've got very weird kind of compound eyes, like spiders and things have compound eyes. So given the variety on Earth, there's going to be a huge variety elsewhere.
If somehow you could talk to those species, maybe we wouldn't even understand what they would be saying because their experience and their perceptual organs are so different.
Yeah. It's like Troy says in Darmok, it's like I point to this and you guys could think red, but I'm thinking t-shirt.
Right.
So that, we're all speaking English, but that simple miscommunication there has said something completely different.
Right. And then even thinking about this topic, I guess we want to go into our honorable mentions. But I had one small one. It was from season 3, it's episode 2, The Essence of Command, with the Sheliak. And when they're discussing the contract negotiations and when they were building the contract. And I think that's the scene where Troy is talking to Picard saying, she just says a random phrase from Beta Zed. And she has the cup in front of her of Earl Grey. And Picard's like, you meant tea. And then she's like, no, maybe I meant the substance is black or the cup is glass and
yes,
so on and so forth. You don't know, right? It takes time for people to find the common threads of the way they perceive things. And
that's right.
Yeah. Wow. All right. So since Shoaib had an honorable mention, do you have one, Joe?
The Big Goodbye, where they're en route to the planet Jarada to do some diplomatic mission, and Picard has to basically learn the greeting.
Oh yeah.
Which goes some like Ar Klaxonis Blag Blan Arnica Nick Ar Krasula Ras Tras Trasula. Kind of like that.
Were you making that up, or was that in...
It sounded very close to it. I remember
it's
Card saying
it. From Chakotay.net, which has all the scripts, so...
Oh, Chakotay.net?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Chakotay,
yeah. But no, that's from the... Yeah, that's where I get a lot of the transcripts for the episodes.
Yes.
But that's how it is in the transcript. That's very good, Joe. You have a real facility for these things. You're our universal translator.
I'm a linguist.
Yep. That's excellent.
Nice. So let's see. For honorable mentions, yeah, there were some that I was thinking about and I was like, well, how much does that extend the topic? But actually, one of the things that I think about is the episode Elementary Dear Data, which is where basically it's the question of whether Moriarty is sentient. And I just kind of love the discussion there. And that just opened my eyes to something, because I was thinking, you know, watching TNG, like, all right, they're humans, they're different alien species, there's an android. I can accept that, you know, all of those are sentient, right? But then thinking about a hologram, like up to that point, it's like, oh, it's just, you know, these projections and there's really nothing more to it or nothing more to consider. Then you get somebody like Moriarty who is in a way like upgraded by the computer towards sentience. And it just opened my eyes like, wow, what if a hologram could be a sentient being? And of course that gets picked up, you know, later on with different instances like the Doctor, Voyager and things like that. But that was one of those moments where I was like, wow, I never would have thought of a hologram being sentient or whether that was a question or not, but it really opened my eyes to that. So that's something that kind of like expanded my mind around a concept, the way they described it.
I suppose you could argue that there is absolutely no difference between Data and Moriarty in terms of substance. Yeah, they're both made of matter and they both have computer programming as intelligence. And so if Data is sentient, then why on earth can't Moriarty be?
Well, I mean, if you can't leave the holodeck, I mean, I mean, is it like in the holodeck, it's like temporarily a form of matter that dissolves when you're outside of the holodeck? Or is it really just like energy and force fields?
But the holodeck does use like kind of replicator technology to produce things like food. And that's why you don't go on for a fancy meal and then leave hungry.
And to like the sheet of paper that Moriarty doodles on that leaves the holodeck. I mean, it must have replicated yeah, that or yeah, something, right?
Exactly. I love that part. Everyone's like, wait, why is it outside the holodeck?
That's why it just, you know, it must replicate stuff. And it must be the case, for example, like if you're eating on the holodeck, that it's actually replicated the food and you're really eating that instead of like it disappearing from your digestive system when you leave yeah, the holodeck, right? Exactly. I mean, that would be weird.
It'd be great if you were on a diet, though. You could go on and like absolutely stuff your face and have whatever you wanted. Like, I'm going to have 5 steaks and 27 donuts, and then I'm going to kind of roll myself out the holodeck and it will disappear.
Yeah. Let's not even think about the bathroom on the holodeck. I don't want to think about that. Wow.
You have to assume that's when they use the transporter, right? Goodbye.
Oh, wow. It just beams out of you, yeah.
That's the big goodbye.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. But seriously, like Star Trek has really opened my eyes to thinking about like androids and holograms and other forms of life being sentient, so that when and if we might encounter that somewhere in the future, as Star Trek fans, we have some kind of basis to think about it. And I think for a lot of other people, it'll be like, no, not really. We'll be like, well, but there were these characters that taught us this. So anyway, that was one of the things that opened my eyes.
Biological life is just a different type of computer, isn't it? I'm sure they've said it on Star Trek, but I actually believe
Picard it. Picard says something like that in The Measure of Man. Like, we're also machines, but we're just like biochemical machines or something like that.
Yeah, our computer programming is just DNA and genes and electrical impulses. And that, and our circuitry is just the nerves that in our brain. There's kind of no difference.
Yeah, it's just the chains of molecules in our brains, right? Reconfiguring and, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, wow. Well, Shoab, this was a great topic that you brought to us about the power of words, language, and communication, and it led to all kinds of great different places. So thank you for bringing this topic. I love it when we get something, we make choices, and we end up talking about things that we never would have expected. So thank you for bringing that topic to us.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, before you go, let our listeners know where they can find you online.
Of course. You can find me on the Babel Conference. I'm often there posting or just at least reading everyone's comments. You can find me on Twitter. My handle is at ShoabAM. It's my first name, ShoabAM. Yeah, I'm on there. You can follow me, hit me up on there. I love talking, chatting about everything.
Okay, excellent. Well, thanks again for coming back to Earl Grey for your second appearance.
Thank you. It's been great. Thank you, Joel. Thank you, Justin.
Thank you, Shoab. It was really good to meet you today.
Yeah, it was really good to talk to you too.
I think there's something in Earl Grey episodes. I have more fun when we have no time to research.
Really?
When it's like the villains episode just was very natural and conversational. And this episode was just, it flowed. And I thought we started 15 minutes ago, but we've been talking for an hour and a half.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
And that's something listeners don't know. So so we had something that didn't work out, and I know that Shoaib, you had some ideas, so we decided to bring you on. And basically, we've been thinking about this topic for about 24 hours. So, yeah.
Can we make a rule in future where we don't get time to organize, and we just, because I perform better when I've, like, see if you message me like half an hour before we start to record and say, Joe, today we're talking about, and I'm like.
But that doesn't work for the episode for the ones where you have to watch episodes.
True, yeah,
I can't tell you half an hour before.
Of course.
But maybe for this type of concept talk discussion, it maybe works good too.
Yeah, for me especially. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. Thanks again, Shoaib. We really appreciate you being here.
All right. Thank you. Until next time.
All right. Well, a preview of next week's episode. So next week, we're going to bring you an interview, and that is with Clyde Kusatsu, who played Admiral Nakamura on several episodes of TNG. So are you excited about that, Joe? It's your first time you'll be interviewing someone on Earl Grey.
I'm vaguely terrified.
You'll do fine.
I know, but it's fine. I'm sure he's a lovely guy. He was at STLV this year, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's where I met him. He was super nice, and I just went up to him and talked with him a little bit and said, hey, would you like to be on Earl Grey? And he was like, I'd love to.
That's so, right. The day you got there, you like networked like a demon, didn't you? And got everybody to come on.
Let's not promise anything else, but I did try to get other interviews, and we'll see what happens with that.
That's cool. Looking forward to it. That's going to be fun.
Have Admiral Nakamura himself, which is cool. First... No, we have interviewed someone else who played an admiral. There was a interview that we did with Natalia Nagulich, who played Admiral Nechayev a while back.
Oh, wow.
But still,
that'd be cool.
Very cool.
Nice. Yeah.
All right. Well, it's been so much fun talking about the power of words, language, and communication in TNG today, but that isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network. Here's what you might have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Edge, a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
Wait, so what switched between your two lists?
Calypso comes in, Runaway comes in second of importance.
Right. Okay.
But Calypso comes in second in enhancement of the season.
Okay. I see.
And
what
really,
you did
even
there.
In importance, I could probably in my head flip Calypso and Runaway because I don't need Runaway.
Literary Treks.
I find that the characters don't quite look like they're actors. You're right. And I think that's because I started to see something, little flashes in both Pike's face and in Number One's face. Is this a representation? And maybe this is totally me reading in way too deep, but is Pike kind of our John F. Kennedy in the sense that Jeffrey Hunter died tragically? Pike's story ended quite tragically as the first pilot. And I think we've been sort of trying to sort of what if him. Right. And I think a lot of people, what if the death and loss of Kennedy in the 1960s as well, which I think also has a lot to do with the hopeful nature of why Star Trek TOS was the way it was. Right.
Earl Grey.
imagine if aliens came to STLV or something like that and said, hey, we're making first contact.
It'd be like, oh, yeah, sure. Oh, wow, that's an amazing cosplay.
Great cosplay. Exactly.
or your cosplay is terrible. Yeah.
Yeah. You're like. You know what? You don't look
Made
like anybody
China.
Who's been in Star Trek. What are you supposed to be?
And introducing our newest show, The Line, a Star Trek Picard podcast.
Alternative factor is better than Nemesis.
Alternative factors. I know you'll say alternative factor is better than a lot of things, and I'll disagree.
I'm going to abstain from an opinion there.
Good. I win. You guys don't fight me on that one.
There you go. Right, an abstention's as good as a no, okay, or a yes.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they are published. And please leave us a star rating and written review. That helps others to find the show.
You read that very smoothly.
I was really trying to get the words right.
Perfect. Well, if you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, YouTube, Windows Phone, and most third-party apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join in the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook and it should come right up. I love the fact that we're talking about like communication and language, and I've lost the ability to speak and form words.
Ugh. What are you talking about? You did great.
It's that it's through concerted effort. It's like if I was a PC, my processors would be 100%.
Well, Joe, you want a bonus question?
My absolute fate. It's the only reason I podcast.
Is it really?
Yes. Oh, wow.
So to keep you here, so in your own life, tell us about the power that words, language, or communication have had.
Oh, that's a good question. So the current version of me is very different to how I used to be in terms of my personality. At school, I was like painfully shy. Like, I always say that I didn't have any friends until like I was like 16, because I just used to hang about with myself. Like I would get embarrassed if I had to talk to people. And then obviously Star Trek taught me a lot about that growing up, but it wasn't enough to kind of overcome my just terror of having to kind of interact with people, whoever they were, teachers, other students. Family was fine because they're family. I kind of came out my shell and changed, got a new personality, a more updated version of myself when I went to university.
Joe 2.0.
Yeah, and I kind of became an adult. I kind of matured and went to university, and you're in a position where you're on your own, so you have to kind of interact with people to get anything done. So wasn't a great I'm going to sound like I hated my childhood. I didn't. I had a great time. I did lots of fun things, but I was just a very different person to I am just now. And like me back then would not be podcasting or even think about doing anything like this.
Wow. I mean, Joe, it's pretty much the same for me, actually. When I was a kid, I really didn't have many or any friends for a lot of the years, and I kind of kept to myself and didn't get along with a lot of people. It was hard for me to talk to kids of my own age. I could talk to adults okay as a kid, okay, which is weird. But then similarly, like I went off to college, and actually I had it in my mind like nobody knows me there. It's a blank slate. I can just try to just hang out and be different, and it was great. And that started me like on the trajectory toward the person that podcasts now. I mean, it's weird, Joe. It's like you had a very similar experience, even though you're in a different part of the world and all that. So
parallel evolution. It's funny if we did kind of perhaps go to the same school at the same time and we were the same, like we wouldn't naturally be friends because we'd both be that person that didn't like talking to the other person. So we could literally be standing beside each other and nobody says a word. And then we go off and do our own thing. Oh, interesting.
Very interesting.
Let's move on. Let's move on from the sad tales of our childhood.
But it's happy now, happy time.
Yeah, it's like therapy. Yeah. I'm going to cry myself to sleep tonight. Oh, dear. Okay, Justin, please continue.
Well, if you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and select Earl Grey. That will come right to us, and we might read your email on the show. So listeners, we haven't gotten as many emails lately. Send us an email with what you think about the show. So you can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. So Joe, where can people find you when you're not speaking like a Temerian? Joe, his eyes open.
Well, Temerian is my first language. English is difficult for me, obviously because I only learned it recently. So yeah, if you want to maybe contact me and chat in Temerian, you can get me on Twitter at joeyjoe77uk. You can email me and I will guarantee you a personal response at joepodcasts@gmail.com. And I got a really nice email from a listener recently who said my impression of Admiral Nora Satie was hilarious and it was pretty on point too. So thank you for that.
You can also, pretty great.
Yes. You can also get me on the Babel Conference where I'm usually lurking around. And Justin, where can people contact you when you're not hanging out with Temba with your arms wide?
Trying to think of a response into Marion, but it's not happening.
It's difficult.
Dharmak Angelata Tanagra. well, you can find me... Oh, boy. You've thrown me off. So you can find me elsewhere on the network co-hosting The Line. That's our Star Trek Picard podcast. I co-host that with my friends Chrissy DeClercq-Zalagi and Brandon Shematala. We have a great time talking about Picard and TNG and Voyager, I guess, and the run-up to everything for Star Trek Picard, where we will talk about those episodes shortly after they air, once they air next year in 2020. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at TrekFan4747, where I tweet about nothing but Star Trek. And you can find me hanging around the Babel Conference on Facebook.
If you'd like to help us keep all our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more, available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
We'd like to take this opportunity to recognize our current associate producers, Norman Lau, Michael Huter, Thomas Appel, Chris Trabuzio, Jim McMahon, Joe Keegan, and me, Justin Ozer. Thank you for supporting Trek FM and especially Earl Grey. So join us next time for another cup of Earl Grey.
Uchim Chefo.
Shaka, when the walls fell.